Great to see you. Great to see you if you're online with us as well this morning. I can see you joining in with the chat. That's been great. In case we've not met before, my name's Chris, and I'm the senior minister here at Andover Community Church. And I get to carry on with a series that Alex started really well for us last week, and I encourage you to go and catch up on that if you haven't yet done so on YouTube, called Included is the name of this series. Now, I want to ask you a question this morning. How are you with mess? How do you do with mess? Some people, I think, are totally fine with mess. In fact, I think there are two different kinds of people. There's one group of people who are totally fine with a bit or even a lot of mess, and there are others who absolutely can't stand it. So, for example, if I showed you these sorts of pictures this morning, I wonder how that would make you feel. So some of you are looking at this saying, yep, and what's the problem? Others of you are squirming when you see these kinds of pictures. You can't bear it. You can't bear the prospect that somewhere there is a room that looks like that. Maybe some of you are thinking about rooms in your house right now that may look a little bit like that. We've got a couple more pictures of some mess. I wonder how that makes you feel. And then here's one for the mums today on Mother's Day. I wonder how that makes you feel. Some of you are like, get that down off the screen. I cannot bear it. Others of you are thinking, yes, and what's the problem? Some of you love a messy home because it represents life and family and friends and activity and all that kind of stuff. Others of you absolutely can't stand it. It sends a shiver down your spine because it represents disorder and chaos and a lack of attention. I think in this world there are two kinds of people. There's those who can't stand mess and those who don't even see it. What about, though, when it isn't a messy home, but a messy world? And I think our world feels a bit messy these days. It feels really uncertain. And uncertainty feels messy. And all of us feel this, whether we would say we were church people or not, whether you've been dragged here today because it's Mother's Day and you're not normally a kind of church person, we're all in the same boat when it comes to this, whether we would be here all the time or very little of the time. We're all in the same boat. We all feel this messiness of our world. Many social commentators these days believe we're in this kind of messy transition as our culture shifts, as we move from a period of cultural stability into another period that they believe is to come where there'll be cultural stability. But in the meantime, it feels really messy. These commentators look back over the history of the world and they say there are these big cultural shifts that seem to take place every so often in the history of the world as the world moves from one period of stability into another. The middle bit is, though, really messy. And those commentators are suggesting that maybe that's where we are these days and have indeed been for the last few years. Mark Sayers, one of those commentators, writes a book called A Non-Anxious Presence. It's a fantastic book, and I highly recommend it. He calls this period of movement between one period of cultural stability into another, the intervening period he calls the gray zone. And again, he says you can see this throughout human history. And we, he says, are in one of those gray zones at the moment, and it feels really messy. And I think many of us would probably understand that and say, yeah, it does feel like that. So much of what our Western world was built on seems to be crumbling down, and we're not quite sure where that leads us in the future. You know, one of the ways that we cope with mess in our homes or in our lives is to attempt to clean up by hiding things away, sweeping things under the carpet, or if you're like me, throwing everything into a cupboard that you can close the door on, and you just pray nobody else will go into. Many of us like to clean up and tidy up our houses in that way. And you know, it comes to culture as well. That when we're in the middle of a cultural kind of mess, or the world feels a bit of a mess, it feels uncertain, we can try to tidy up. And many people in our world and in our culture these days are trying to do that. They're trying to tidy up. One of the ways that we so often deal with cultural shifts or uncertainty is to try to tidy up by defining or drawing lines. Lines which ultimately actually become barriers to determine what we think is okay and what isn't. And that's the way that we try to tidy up. We try to figure out where we are and to label where other people are. And that feels to us a little bit like just trying to tidy up when the world feels messy. So we label people. we create dividing lines. We say things, for example, like, are you left or right in your politics? Are you affirming or non-affirming in your views about sexuality and marriage? Are you inclusive or exclusive? In church world, we say, are you evangelical or are you liberal? Are you progressive or are you orthodox? And that's how we try to tidy up, oftentimes, a messy kind of world. And in a messy world, the temptation to draw lines to try to tidy up gets deeper and deeper and becomes often to us more and more attractive. Because lines feel safe to us. You on your side, me on mine. At least we all know where we stand, and somehow that kind of feels safe. It allows for us to feel self-righteous. It allows for us to feel satisfied, and it feels oftentimes easier for us and tidier for us. But the problem is that badly drawn lines divide people. Badly drawn lines become legalistic and insensitive. Badly drawn lines exclude people, and they get in the way of real relationships. Badly drawn lines may seem to give a short-term solution or answer, but in the longer term, they're harmful and damaging and dividing. But we do need some lines, right? We do need some lines. I mean, we can't live without some kind of framework to live by. When I was little, I had a mate came and stayed over for the weekend, and my dad took us out to play football, and we had a playing field near us that was massive and had loads of different football pitches on it. And my dad decided on this particular day, rather than playing like on a normal pitch, we would play what he invented, a game he invented called Round the Corner Football. My dad loved to invent games for us. And it was called Round the Corner Football, and it used two goals that faced in opposite directions on different football pitches. And my dad decided, and he very quickly came to realize the foolishness of this decision, that we would play with no boundaries whatsoever, that there would be no lines, we could go wherever we wanted in this massive playing field. And he decided it would be me and my mate against him, which he very quickly regretted when we used the whole of the playing fields and took the ball miles away and ran rings around him and scored tons of goals in round the corner football. We never played that again. I think my dad realized that day that some kind of boundaries are indeed helpful. Some kind of framework is important, not just for playing sport, but for life, actually, because otherwise it all just becomes a free-for-all like round the corner football became that day, and that's damaging. That's damaging too. And actually the reality is we all have frameworks that we live by. We all have some kind of code that we live by. Again, whether we would say we were a Christian or not, we have frameworks, codes, lines, boundaries that we live by. So perhaps the most important question of all is not what are the lines, but perhaps we should be asking who or what draws the lines in our lives? Who determines what the lines should be? And are they worthy of determining what those lines should be in our lives? Who are the people that you're allowing to draw those lines and frameworks and boundaries for you in your life? What's their posture? Are they genuinely for you, or are they actually for their own agenda? Are they actually only trying to tidy up their own mess and anxiety by drawing a line for you? Today we're going to look at an extraordinary event from the life of Jesus, in which Jesus issues a challenge to the line drawers of his day. And we shall see as we look at this event and this encounter that Jesus way preferred circles to lines. He preferred to invite people into relationship with him. He preferred a circle of inclusion rather than a line of exclusion. When he does draw lines, he draws them from within the circle, standing with people, in relationship with people, reaching out to people rather than at a distance, making demands on people. His posture was very different. And the story that we're looking at today is an example of Jesus' model of operating in circles being put to the test. And we're going to look at it, and it comes from John's eyewitness account to the life of Jesus that's in the New Testament part of the Bible. It happens early one morning. Jesus has come into Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives, where he was staying, just to the east of the city. He came in, as was often his practice, and he went to the temple courts, the center and heart of the Jewish religious faith, and he began to teach people there, something he did often. But suddenly, as he was teaching, there was a rude interruption. The religious leaders of the day, the scribes and the Pharisees, they burst in and they bring with them a woman. And this is the story as John recounts it for us in chapter 8 of his account of the life of Jesus. It says this: at dawn, he, this is Jesus, appeared again in the temple courts where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery." Now, 2,000 years ago, this was really bad stuff. And she's not just been caught, we've been told she's been caught right in the middle of an act of adultery. So there's no doubt about this. And this was real trouble. People caught in the act of adultery were in real trouble because the religious law, the lines that had been drawn of the time, said that they should be stoned to death. That was a very clear line that had been drawn. And the teachers of the law and the religious zealots of the time, they knew the law and they knew what the punishment was for what she had done. They knew all about the religious requirements. They knew where the lines and the boundaries and the frameworks were. But they also knew that Jesus loved people. And they didn't like Jesus because Jesus was different. He was a different kind of teacher, a different kind of rabbi from that they'd experienced before. He wasn't like the usual teachers and preachers. He didn't lord his power over people. He wasn't interested in material riches or resources or status or class. And he was introducing people to God in a way that drove those other religious leaders totally nuts. He said things about God that they disagreed with. He said that God was for people. Jesus had a new approach, a new way to approach God. He was redrawing and redefining the lines, and he was challenging the old way of thinking. So they tried to trap him. So they bring this woman before him, and they say, "Jesus, she's been caught in the act of adultery. What will you do?" They say this: "In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Here's the line that's been drawn. Now, what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. They fire questions at Jesus to try to get him to pick a side, to draw a line. Will he stand with the law and with the scriptures, or will he stand with the woman? Will he stand with the sinners? They are challenging him. What will he do? They're trying to force Jesus to draw a line when they know that Jesus is for people. They think that Jesus will have no choice. And by the way, the woman is just a pawn in their religious games. You know what the law said? The law said that all parties caught in the act of adultery were supposed to be stoned. And last time I looked, it took at least two people to commit an act of adultery. Where's the other one? And if it was a man, where's the man here? He should be here too. So they really don't care about what she's been caught doing or not doing. They just want to use her to trap Jesus. She's a pawn in their religious games. Can you imagine what it was like for her? Standing there, maybe naked, having been dragged out, no dignity, everybody talking about her, everybody whispering about her in a very public setting. People accusing her and condemning her. And whispering about her. And these Pharisees and the teachers of the law, they don't give a stuff about her. They don't care about her at all. But Jesus sees her. He really sees her and he feels her pain and her anguish. But he's being pushed into drawing a line, into making a statement. I love what Jesus does, by the way, here. This is like a bit weird, but great. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. Can you imagine being the woman? She's kind of like, well, isn't helping. What are you doing? Wouldn't it be amazing to have a photograph of whatever it was that he was doing down in the dust? We don't really know. Anyway, he's doing something on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "That any one of you is without sin, be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. This is all a bit strange. Can you imagine the woman again? Almost the first thing she must have heard was Jesus kind of going, "All right, stone her." And her heart must have sank. But then Jesus says, "But you who are without sin, you cast the first stone." You see, the line was there. The line was that she was supposed to be stoned. But Jesus issues a challenge of his own in the response to the challenge he is receiving. He says, "Okay, well, you of you that never messed up, those of you who have never sinned, never done anything wrong, well, you throw the first stone." He stoops down again on the ground. Look what happens next. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. Interesting that the older ones go first, isn't it? Perhaps they're very aware or more aware of their own shortcomings, of what's gone on in the course of their life. But of course, there's nobody left, because there's nobody there who's never messed up, because everybody does. You see, in theory, nobody qualifies to be in a relationship with a holy and a pure God, because everybody's messed up, everybody breaks the laws, everybody crosses the line, and Jesus is simply highlighting the hypocrisy of the position of everybody else who is there. Nobody, Jesus is saying, is better than anybody else. Everybody needs grace. Everybody needs a circle that they're invited into. Jesus was challenging that hypocritical mindset that says, us and them, you on your side of the line, me on mine. I'll be on my side of the righteousness line, and I'll tell you on the other side of the line where you're not being righteous and what should happen to you. Everybody there knew in their hearts that they've done bad things, that they've messed up, that they've been selfish, that they've sinned, and so they fade away, and the woman is left there with Jesus. See, Jesus does this radical redrawing of the lines. In fact, it's not really a line at all. Jesus takes the line and makes it into a circle. I love that about him. And yes, adultery was a very serious crime, and she was caught right in the middle of it. And yes, the religious law, the line of the day, said she should be stoned. Everything about the situation demanded that Jesus should agree with the scribes and the Pharisees and give the go-ahead for her stoning. But instead, Jesus takes that line and makes it a circle. He finds the way to love. He finds the way to grace and mercy. He finds the way to invite her in. And actually, he was the only one who was there who could have thrown the stone, because he was without sin. And instead, he finds the way to love. And we have this amazing moment at the end of the story in verses 10 and 11. And it says this: Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has nobody condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." See, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, they knew all about God. They knew all about the religious traditions and the religious laws. They knew where the lines were drawn. They believed in God, but they weren't following God. They weren't after God's heart. They hadn't seen into the very heart of who God is, and that God's heart is for people. The whole point of the law in the first place was to free people and liberate people, to live in a relationship with God. God's not about condemnation. He's about liberation. And Jesus understands that. So Jesus refuses to condemn her and instead finds the way to grace and mercy. And yes, he does issue a challenge to her. He issues a challenge to her to go away and sin no more, to modify her behavior. But it's really, really important to notice the posture of Jesus when he does that. Jesus challenges her to change. He challenges her to leave behind a destructive pattern that is destroying her life and destroying, presumably, the life of other people as well. And he challenges her and he draws a line for her, but it's being drawn after he has invited her into the circle where there is no condemnation or judgment. He has proved that he is for her before he challenges the behavior in her life. So important to notice that. The position from which the line is being drawn is one of relationship and community, one of inclusion and not exclusion, and that is Jesus' posture. And the motivation is also important to notice here. The motivation for the line that Jesus draws and the challenge that he gives to her is one of love, not condemnation, wanting the best for her. What is going to bring her life and joy in all of its fullness, not destruction. One that is going to restore and enable real relationships and not break them. But the order again is crucial. She is forgiven and set free by Jesus, and out of that then comes the challenge to change. It's not do this and do that, live up to this line or that line. It's not that. And then you can have a relationship with me. That's not how Jesus works. It's have the relationship, be invited into the circle, and then begin to change. So what's our response then to this extraordinary event from the life of Jesus? What's the challenge that Jesus is laying down here to us then? Well, I think it's twofold. And they both have to do with circles and not with lines. The first is to realize that each and every one of us is invited in to Jesus' circle. See, in this encounter, we see Jesus reaching out, finding the way of love, refusing to condemn. And in doing so, he points us to the nature and character of God. Jesus shows us that nothing we can do is too bad to stop God reaching out to us. And that God reaches out to us first. And he does so in the form of Jesus. He wants us to belong in his company and believe that he is for us. And yes, then he will challenge us to change and transform, all of us. But it starts when God reaches out to us, where God invites us into a circle that will change and transform our lives. It's about God's motivation for wanting us to change, which is because he wants the best for us. And today, God is reaching out again to you, maybe for the first time, maybe for the 100th time. Maybe you felt that you couldn't possibly be included by God. Maybe you think that whatever that thing is in your life that you are most ashamed about and you don't want anybody to know about would somehow separate you from God. It's not the case. Jesus draws a circle to include you. It's really important that we know this and we understand it. No matter how much we think we've messed up, no matter how much we think we're unworthy, no matter how much we have low self-esteem or low self-image, no matter how much we mess up, we can never lose God's love. We can never get to such a place that he wouldn't want to draw a circle that includes us. God does not condemn us. He invites us in. We need to allow that to sink in. The second way to respond to all of this is to resolve to be about circles, not lines, in our own lives and in our church. Here's what I really want to say, that if you're part of our church community or you're a Christian or whatever, here's what I want you to take away if you remember nothing else from today. You and I are not supposed to be the line drawers. Because each and every one of us is messed up. Each and every one of us falls short. Each and every one of us is selfish from time to time. Each and every one of us finds ways to not follow the way of love. We're not equipped to draw the lines. That's the job of a perfectly loving and gracious God. That's the position and posture we should all want and look to in the person who we're going to look towards to define the boundaries and the frameworks for our life. We should want somebody to do that who is perfectly for us, who loves us beyond measure, who is gracious and merciful and includes us in circles. That's the kind of person I would want to draw lines in my life and to give me tracks and boundaries in which I follow, because he is perfectly for me. He is the line drawer. Our job is to be about inviting people into the circle. And we need sometimes to assess where we have drawn lines that exclude others and take steps to remove them. Reality is that Jesus has accepted us and does not condemn us. And that should motivate us to treat others that way too. Or else we are hypocrites. The reality that we're all in the same boat when it comes to needing God's grace and love and forgiveness should give us the humility and the compassion to draw circles to include others and not try to draw lines that exclude them, no matter how much we want to tidy up this messy world in which we live. Imagine a world where people aren't constantly trying to deal with their anxiety and their mess by accusing, labeling, and cancelling each other, and drawing lines which exclude and which divide. Imagine a community which models Jesus' non-judgmental love and acceptance of others, a community where people feel like they belong, where people feel like they aren't judged by who they are or their behaviors or what they believe. Imagine a community where from that posture, we are figuring out together the lines and the challenges that Jesus would draw for us, that he would give us, so that we become more like him and live more in the way he would want us to live. The real and authentic change that Anyone who has decided to follow Jesus is called to, comes from that decision to follow Jesus and allowing him and the work of his presence, his spirit, to change and transform us. We must resist the pull to be the line drawers ourselves when we are challenged or invited to do so. We must find our doodle in the sand moment when we're being challenged to draw a line and not a circle. When we are challenged to draw a line, why don't we follow the Jesus way and find a way to draw a circle instead? When you find someone who you disagree with politically or in beliefs or moral codes or behaviors, why not reach out and ask some great questions and listen instead? When you see somebody of a different ethnicity or cultural background to you, why don't you reach out with the hand of friendship and be curious? When you see someone who's doing something that makes you feel uncomfortable, why not extend a hand of kindness instead of drawing a line to keep them on the other side of a barrier to you? When you see someone looking lost or isolated, why not move to welcome them and include them? And that might make things messy. It might make your life messy. It's absolutely for sure going to make our church messy. But hey ho, Jesus was messy. That's why people looked at him all the time and said, why do you keep hanging out with all those messy people? Well, because he was messy, because he refused to draw lines to exclude people and instead drew circles to include them. He attracted people who others were just judging or shunning. I love this about Jesus. It was radical and culturally countercultural and challenging, and actually it changed our world. It changed the ethics of our world. He loved people, he stood up for them, he led them. And that led him to paying the ultimate price with his life. Because people wanted him to draw lines and instead he drew circles. He was prepared to do that because he radically loved people. And from that posture, yes, he challenged them. And he challenges us to follow him and to live in a certain way. But it's from that place of inclusion, not exclusion. That's the Jesus I want to follow. That's the person I want to be like. And I think we all should. And as a church, as his body, we should want and seek to be like that too. Let's pray, shall we? So a little bit later on, we've got a few songs to sing. But after the first couple of these songs we're going to sing, then we're going to talk about what next steps we might take in response to this. And we're going to pray about that. You know, we love a next step around here. But before we get to that, I just wanted us to spend a little bit of time in gratitude and thankfulness to God that he would reach out to us. Because when we understand that, it sets the framework for everything else. So Heavenly Father, thank you for your great and including love for us. Thank you that you invite us in to a circle. Thank you that in Jesus you showed in a very visual and graphic demonstration just how you feel about us, that you sent your son. You sent your son to give his life to show just how far you'll go to include us in a circle. Thank you that we are invited in to that circle. Thank you that yes, it will change and transform us, that there will be frameworks and boundaries and lines by which we live our life, but it will come from a place of love and graciousness, of no condemnation, of no judgment, and out of a motivation for us to live in a way that's best for us. Thank you for giving us Jesus. Thank you for these extraordinary events in his life, which showed for us just his nature and character and your nature and character. We are so grateful.